people never care about backups until they really have this fear of losing something very important. Like they have to actually hit the wall, fear that they might have lost something or actually got very close to losing something before they start like worrying about doing things right.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we improve production by challenging the status quo. Your host, Armin Astani from Cherto Modo.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we explore how to make software and systems more reliable by challenging the status quo. I'm your host, Amin Astani. When I say reliability, what comes to mind? In our industry, probably a couple things. The reliability of your software or the infrastructure it runs on. That makes sense. Software has bugs and performance problems, and infrastructure gets complex and fragile when designed poorly or ignored as traffic scales. But here's a question we don't ask often enough. What about your data? Your databases, your application state, your designs, your reports, the business doesn't function without them. And most teams think they got this covered. You got replication. You got a cloud provider offering you automated snapshots and 11 nines of durability, so your data's safe, right? No, not really. Replication will copy your data corruption, ransomware, and your accidental update SQL statement without a where clause. High availability saves you when a server or even a data center dies, but it does nothing when someone accidentally runs a stray rm-rf command. And the one thing that actually gets you out of trouble restoring from a backup is that thing almost nobody ever tests. My guest today has been spending a lot of time staring at this problem. Gilles Shahad is an IT architect and senior lead developer, a longtime OpenBSD contributor, and the creator of OpenSMTPD. He's also the co-founder of Placker, an open source backup and restore platform. Operating systems, email infrastructure, and backups. A man after my own heart. Really eager to get this conversation started. Gilles, great to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm really excited. So to start, tell us a little bit about your background. Specifically, how did you get into tech, the OpenBSD community, and writing email server software of all things?
So I got into computers because my parents gave me a computer when I was a kid and they forgot to buy games. So I only had a manual. I could type some basic stuff on it. And I got I really enjoyed like typing some lines of code that I did not understand and see actually something happened. And then I would reproduce kind of the same thing. And as studies go, I went to Epitech in Paris, which is a computer science school that used to be mainly about programming and people that were willing to spend a lot of time in code. Yeah. I discovered OpenBSD back then when I was entering. I think it was in the first year. And I realized that I really enjoyed BSD, Unix, the console, and command line tools.
Right,
and system administration also. Yeah. During my studies, to pay a bit of my studies, I did some system administration here and there. So that was the first time I had to face the issues of backup and data loss, because usually I would be contracted by someone to solve a small issue, which turned out to always be we lost something huge and we don't know how to get it back.
Yeah,
and it kind of I was very interested in OpenBSD, which is very high focus on security but also on correctness, and so there was also this overlap between but you guys are having a bad infrastructure, so maybe I can help making it better. If I have my free hands to choose what I would pick OpenBSD and I would do the backups, and it's all puzzled together, glued together as different topics of interest. I graduated from Epitech and went into two parallel careers. One that was heavily into open source, so I never left open source. I don't know, 2008 until now, I'm still doing some open source. That has always been around my work. Yeah, and on the other side, I was either working as R&D developer or or I would say consultant, security consultant, or like related. Yeah, and yeah, that's most of my career has been around these topics in one way or another.
Yeah, I love that. It sounds like we have a pretty similar background. I had like an old 386 machine and a stack of DOS 5 books, maybe a little bit later on, but and then of course computer science, and then yeah, I did sysadmin work in my undergrad, so it looks like we have a similar background, which is always cool to see. I love sysadmins. All right, so backups, like, what got you interested in this space specifically, and more importantly, what happened to you?
Yeah,
put backups on the radar. What happened to you?
So I have this thing where I think people never care about backups until they really have this fear of losing something very important. Like they have to actually hit the wall, fear that they might have lost something or actually got very close to losing something before they start like worrying about doing things right on this year. When I was a student, I was in third year, and we had this this long year project where most of your grades you are going to be graded on that the most. Yeah. And like 2 weeks before the final defense, my drive dies. I'm like the initial shock is, oh well, I'm going to do the third year again because there's no way I'm getting out of this. Then I did have some, like, not really backups, but I did have copies here and there. So it turns out that I managed to lose only 1 week. Yeah. But as you know, 1 week when you're at the end of the year is like 2 months worth of work. And at that point, I started backing up everything because I realized that anything that was valuable to me might be lost. So machines at home, machines at work, if they had something that belonged to me, I would copy them to two or three places, usually in different different providers, because I was being overly cautious about this. And then as my career went, I realized that every place I went to at some point had some data loss, and they never had the proper solution to cope with that. It was always like reactive. They would lose something, try to get the latest copy that they might have saved somewhere using whatever tool they have. And in some places they would have backups, but they did not do the proper classification about what should be backed up. So they would end up having partial restores or restores of stuff that's not that important, whereas the important stuff got lost. And so as years went by, I realized that more and more people that were coming from computer science, that they were supposed to be literate on that, someone that's not in computer science would look at them as being the people who know how to do that stuff. They would never get it right. And I started like digging into this. So I did a few projects myself. I did like some kind of encrypted tar and stuff like that would try to deduplicate a bit, and that I would put in my workflow everywhere I'd go. So I have like five or six predecessors to Placar. There were different attempts doing different things. Yeah. And I realized during that time that I have a friend who started a company who almost killed his company for not doing backups the right way. He was using a set of script. At another company, people, they all assumed that someone else was doing it, so no one was doing it. At other companies, some were doing it properly, but no one checked that they worked. And everywhere, they did not use the same tools, because we don't have in that industry, like we have for databases or source code versioning, we have standards and things where wherever you go, you will find that tool. And in the backup world, if you go in the open source world, you will have 20 different solutions that are tackling things in a bit different way. And in the corporate world, you have also different solutions. Some are very expensive, so you don't see them at every company. And they are closed source, so you have to trust the vendor that everything is going to be still around in 20 years. And there's no consensus that you would go like, this is a good solution, and everyone says, yeah, this is a good solution. That does not exist. So that prompted me to spending more time trying to resolve why has no solution outsmart the others, like why no solution came as the first one.
I definitely appreciate the story and the narrative, from the personal to like the, you know, what's happening in industry. So you've mentioned, yes, there's vendors, there's technology out there, there's a bunch of different approaches, but like, in your view, what's missing? What isn't working? What's making it so that backups as a operational competency isn't sticking at companies, really?
Well, I think it's a matter of you will always have to do some trade-offs. That's whatever solution you use for whatever problem you have in computer science, you're going to make trade-offs, yeah. And I think a lot of solutions, if you go on in the open source world, a lot of them do the trade-off that everything is a file system, and that's the main target. You're going to back up a file system, and that's the only way to think to reason about the issue, yeah. And so they disregard what's happening. Actually happening in companies, which is a very heterogeneous environment where you have object stores, databases, you have file system, but you have also block devices, and you have all kinds of stuff that do not fit just the simple let's backup file system scenario. Yeah, they are also very okay. Let's take a step back on this. It's not a sexy topic. No one's interested in backup unless they have to do it. Yeah, so the end result is that no one's going to pour a lot of time making shiny things about this. They will have done their software targeted at a geek audience that's going to have a learning curve, and that's okay for them. Yeah, and at some point in my life, I would think, yeah, that's okay. You can have a learning curve with this. But if it's a so sensitive topic that you should never get it wrong, having a learning curve on that is an issue to me. Yeah. Then you have the open the corporate world where you can rely on closed source solution. They will do the shiny things, but they will try to vendor lock you in because there's no benefit in providing a software that you could just run and then migrate to someone else easily. You'd rather have everything, so closed formats and everything like that. And that trade-off, in my sense, is where you lose something because people to get a standard, you have to have a low learning curve. Yeah, and you have to have to not be vendor locked. You have to become a standard. Yeah, and to become a standard, you have to enable an ecosystem and make it easy for like everyone to build tools around your own tool, which is something that no commercial vendor will allow you to do, and which is very complex to do if the tool is open source but has a high learning curve and no one wants to contribute because it's not a sexy topic. So you have all this that mixes in. And then there's one thing that comes more from my OpenBSD background, which is OpenBSD has a philosophy of having everything work out of the box with little to zero configuration. Like things should be sent out of the box. And so this means that you run it, it works. Yeah. And no one takes that step outside the OpenBSD world. It's not a common thing to say, oh, you should have zero config, just run it and it works. But it's the way that at Placard we think of the product. Like you should be able to run it, and if you have to do some configuration, which you will have to do in backup, it has to be the smallest one, and anything you change is just to get away from default because you're in a special case.
No, that makes a lot of sense. It's hard. It's a hard place to be to have a principle, to be principled and disciplined around something that isn't sexy. I think that's really in essence what you're talking about. And it's true. I mean, it could be said about reliability, but I think backups even more so. So let's put aside the obvious, like losing data, it's a pain in the butt, it is business impacting. But besides that obvious stuff, what are the other major risks that are associated with losing data outside of just like not having access to it?
So beside being a pain in the bottom, let's say, the thing is that it's more than that. Some companies, they have just closed because they lost their data and could not recover. So it's like it's a vital thing to have, yeah. But yeah, there's also the how do you say? There's also a misconception about losing data, what it means for people. Yeah. A lot of people, they would assume that, well, they put it in the cloud, so it's okay. Yeah. But actually, it's not okay. You have a shared responsibility between cloud providers and you. They will have in the small lines that, yeah, your data might go away. Yeah. And if it goes away, it's your responsibility to make sure that it's safe. Within that data, there's stuff that you may at some point think, I don't have that many data that's vital. If I lost my computer, that would not be a problem. If I lost my phone, that would not be a problem. But then when you start digging, you realize that there's a ton of things you are emotionally attached to. Like besides working or keeping work aside, the fact that you have some data like pictures, like myself, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of pictures of my kid. If I lost that, and that's not vital from a perspective of a company or anything else, it's just personally that would make me very sad, very depressed to lose that stuff. And if you push that aside, I discussed with someone who was telling me the same at an event. I don't have anything because, well, I do have my accounting stuff, but my accountants do it. Yeah, but computer science people don't get it right. Your accountants are going to get it right. You don't check about this. And then when you have this, you realize that it's not only a matter of losing data, but also of having a relaxed mind, where you know that you have a safety net somewhere that's not going to drive you into a bad situation. And sometimes just having that also means that when you are having an incident, which is something that will happen in computer science, there's no company that has no incident. But the resolution of an incident when you are very stressed about what you can possibly do, and the fact that you know that you have so many safety guards behind, it's just something that makes resolution faster, because you get less of the chicken headless effect that people have during incidents, where they fear touching anything by fear of making things worse. Yeah. So it's not only data loss; it's the whole. It's an insurance policy, basically. You have to have that as a way to be relaxed.
Yeah, you're definitely speaking my language on the incident response side. Like, it's really hard to make like decisions that are sane when, like you said, chicken with the head cut off, your amygdala is firing, you're stressed out, you're in panic mode. You can't make good decisions in that state.
I have an anecdote about this, and it kind of ties to backup indirectly, but there was an
Sure.
incident at some company, and database had lost the last hour of data, which was on something like network related. So it's not huge data, but it means that any machine that had been provisioned IP addresses was being reassigned the same as the new one that just had that IP collision everywhere. So it's really, really madness. Yeah. And the guy was very, really stressed, because he was not sure he could resolve the backups. The document was outdated. So he was like, if I run that command, will it do what I think? And under the stress, the best idea he had was, let's truncate and resolve from something. And truncating, which was something no one would do. You're in an incident, the last thing you want to do is make it worse, but seemed to him under stress as the best solution to do before applying backups, which obviously made things worse. And that's a person, if you would ask him out of the incident, what if someone does that, he would tell you that's stupid. Like, no one does that. But under incidents, you're no longer yourself. You are, well, people have different levels, but a lot of people, they don't deal well with that. And if you are overly stressed, because even on top of the incident, you're not sure about your backups behind, it makes everything worse.
That
And you see
sounds
how
very
docs,
relatable.
and the backups were there, the doc was outdated, which is side, that's like cherry on top. You
Oh,
have everything,
wow.
but you're not even sure you can use it.
Right. So it isn't just the existence of the backups. It's also the process of being able to restore them and having that be fully exercised and mature.
It's to me, it's both the fact that you test them regularly and the fact that you know upfront that they are good. Which is like backups. That's something that we used to say that a lot in events when talking to people. A lot of the data coming from backup is considered as dead weight by companies. It's dead data that you just capture, store, and hope to never have to look at again. Even if you test it, it's not data that's live that you will use regularly. Yeah, and one of the things we did at Packard, for example, was to provide a preview, a live preview of your backup, and you would browse them as if you are using a Google Drive. Yeah, which seems like a fun feature, but the thing is that when you do that, and you actually don't consider your backup as dead data, but you actually browse it, look at it, your stress about having to use that under an incident goes away, because you already use it in a like regular basis. It's not dead data. It's read-only data that's locked, but it's live data in some sense.
There's something inherent in that. Like, if you're able to browse backups that are in flight or recent, you have already validated that the backup in fact worked. It is POSIX, you see files in there. Is it the data that you expected? Like, there's a lot of benefit to that for sure. All right, so let's drive the point home to really get our listeners' attention, right? So you've mentioned a couple of horror stories about data loss, but mind telling us a couple more? I'm sure you have some scary ones in your archive that you can dust off for just this occasion.
So yeah, I have two that were very, very interesting in my point of view. The first one was that so I mentioned it a bit fast earlier, but I have a friend who was doing both an non-profit organization work, yeah, and he was running a training company and had like all his prospect and training material and stuff like that. He was writing his backups to an FTP server using whatever script he wrote himself, as someone who was computer literate. And that thing has been running for a while. He used to get alerts if there was something wrong. Yeah. And at some point, there was a problem with his provider. So he tuned out, he yeah, tuned down some of the alerts and left it running for a while. Then he contacted me after a few months, and he was like devastated because his server would not boot. The provider was one of the cheap providers that you find in Europe where they give you a server, but you're supposed to do your backups. And if the machine dies, they will not spend time to get the drives out. If the machine dies, it's a replacement. Yeah. And he realized that one of the errors that was turned down was a disk full on the target machine. So it's been months of intense work and prospecting and saving your prospect and doing the new material for the trainings that were not backed up, silently ignored. And yeah, I was like, I don't even know how I can contact my prospect. I have no email address, nothing. I lost everything. And he was very lucky because that was at the time where I was initially writing Packer, and I did test my code on every machine I had access to. So I did have a backup of his stuff, but that was purely coincidental. That's not me anticipating a risk. That was me testing my code like at his place, like I would do another to have multiple systems, multiple distros available. Yeah. And so he went from my company is done to okay, I'm in a very stressful situation, but there's a way out in a matter of minutes based only on a tool, just on having a tool plugged correctly. So that was the first one, and that was to me, a bit inspiring, because that would be someone who's not computer literate. I would say, yeah, well, anyone can do a mistake, but when you know that that even people like him are able to do that mistake and like possibly kill a company on losing data, you realize that there's something that's wrong in the tooling, just the tooling in that area of our industry. Yeah, and the second one was at a big company where I was operating as an architect. And I was working in an area which was highly regulated, so you had to have backups for extended periods of time. And you had, like I did when I joined that business unit, I did an investigation of the various diagrams that they would have on every project. And one thing I did not see anywhere where the backups were going. Yeah, how are you backing up? And none of the projects had this documented. That does not mean that they did not have backups. They just did not document it where it goes. And so I started looking at it, asked one of the lead developers where his backups going, because they were supposed to be kept for 10 years. And he told me, well, they are done by the SREs. I'm like, okay, well, I will go ask the SREs because maybe it's not appearing in the schemas because they do some low-level snapshotting of the machines. And I go to the SRE who tells me, well, the lead devs do it. And I'm like, no, they don't. They think you do it. And it was like, oh, well, let's do that on Monday. We are Thursday, I think. And I told him, no, we do shitty backups today. We have backups today. Whatever they have, script something, but I want backups today. Then on Monday, we do the proper ones. We find a proper solution, but you can't have a one more day going without backups. So database died on the weekend, and that was only saved by these backups. So I was more worried that he would assume I trashed something to prove a point during the weekend, but no, it's just yeah. I went into so many contracts and so many companies. It has to happen sometimes that you lose data the wrong time. But yeah, he was saved by this. And in this case, it's regulatory data. You just can't admit to losing it because no one knew who did the backups. And it was in that case, you have both a technical problem, which is nothing was in place. You have a process problem, who does what and who's responsible of what. And you have a problem of communication, documentation. And and you realize that from the guy who has one server, they can do it right. And you have big companies with multiple business units that can do it right either. It's, yeah, there's a big hole.
Yeah, it seems. Oh my goodness. I mean, in my experience, I've seen like companies just do EBS snapshots, like block device snapshots on Amazon without flushing the disk, and we're like, oh yeah, we have volumes, but we don't really know if the data on them is in fact an intact
Yeah.
data set. Yeah.
You have something that was also that's kind of a modern problem, because when I started
Yeah.
computer science, we were like in the 90s,
Yeah.
there were not so much data. You did not have as much data, so you would have like everything fits on a few drives. You're going to be fine with that. Now the thing is that you have AI that comes and that incentivizes you to keep as much data as you want. And already before AI, you still had like a huge growth of the data sets, and like every year you would have more and more and more like we went from gigabytes to terabytes and petabytes in just a couple of decades, so it went very fast. Yeah. And before AI, you would be at some point you would go like, that data is stale, let's throw it away, it is stale, we don't use it anymore. You do some garbage collecting. Now you have an incentive to not do that anymore, and even stale data still is valuable, and you might train something on it. So it's not going to go any lighter on this, I think. And so the problems that you had already going from a few gigabytes to a few terabytes are worse and worse on that aspect, because they affect the time you take to do things. The fact that, for example, something that takes a certain amount of time might no longer fit your periodicity for backups. I have something for that, an anecdote on that again. At former company, there was a backup that had to be done once a day, and that took 25 hours. So you can't do one a day. It's
Awesome.
just, yeah. And so you are affected by by the physics, actually. There's
Yeah.
rules you can't bend anymore, and you have to work around with what's the best that I can achieve in that framework. Framework of physics. What can I do in that?
Yeah, that's wow. Yeah. That all makes sense. We do live in the age of data lakes and data warehouses, and I wonder if these things are being backed up. And yeah, this isn't backup. This was geo-replication in the example I'm thinking about. But you know, I remember working with a company that had customers with hundreds of thousands of inodes, and they're rsyncing from one region to another. And it would take longer than the actual periodicity that the data needed to be fresh on the other region. So if there was a problem and they had to fail over, you would be at least an hour out. Yeah. Yeah.
We always had that latency issue, because when you were having multi-region databases, for example, you
Yeah.
would try to synchronize. That has always been a problem, but it was
Yes.
at a manageable scale, where you would say,
Yeah.
okay, now when you have people that tell you, oh, I have 100 terabytes of data to move from that place to that place, and it has to be fast. Yeah, well, fast is kind of an
Yeah.
issue here, and you have to find the proper ways to do this. And part of it is also, in my sense, coupled to the backup and what we do at Placar, part of the duplication. Because what you realize is that in a lot of these data sets, there's no reasoning about that data is duplicate. So we try to, in some way, get it out of the data set before pushing anything, because that's a huge task on its own that takes a lot of time on its own. And so
Yeah.
you get any small change carries the bulk of the unchanged data with it. And there's attempts here and there to do some deduplication, but if they are not at the proper level, you still get to carry a lot of waste on this. And this waste translates to network transfers. It carries to processing on the other side, to indexes here and there, to disk writes. So it's like a kind of a snowball effect. If you don't do it upfront, you pay the cost of this duplication everywhere, and your synchronization to the other data center is more costly on every single aspect.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned AI a little bit in your previous reference to horror stories. So over the past year, like it's in the news now, it is very prominent in our minds. You know, businesses are losing their data. In some cases, businesses are losing their backups too, due to some LLM misbehaving. They got Claude Code running and they're YOLO mode, and they're just letting it, you know, run roughshod over their codes and their systems. So what is your view on how AI technology has made data loss all the more likely?
Yeah. So before I would say, I would tend to say you might lose, you have statistics on how much like drives die on the year. So you have a small percentage of chance that it will die this year, and it increases as years go. Yeah. So you would, you tend initially to assume that data loss is kind of the result of either you have a hardware, like hardware failure, and that's very unlikely, but it will happen, but you can cover for that, and you can estimate how much cost you want to put on the, like, redundancy of the hardware based on your data set and its value. And you would assume that, oh, and there's also the like remote attackers that might like compromise and destroy things, and they will spend that much to compromise, and you might spend that much on security. But now you have AI that's again a wonderful tool. I'm not it's not too bad mouse AI. I think it's a wonderful tool, but it also has a lot of bad sides to it. And one of the bad sides is that it runs internally. Like, you usually give it the permissions that you give your devs or your SREs, and you have people that are now internal to your company that run tools that may, in the best places, have different privileges, but most of the case they use the person token, so they have the same access. And so now the threat is not a remote threat and about how much protection you put, how much cost you put at entering your network. It's more, okay, the attacker is already inside and just waiting to trigger something. Yeah, so that's the first part. The second part is that anyone who has used Claude or any other long enough knows that besides hallucination, it often takes some like personal takes on how to solve an issue of its own. So it will take steps that the person did not anticipate or did not tell it to do. Yeah, and I have two also two anecdotes on that. One is AI security officer at Meta, who posted on LinkedIn and X a while back to say, I was eating and I was watching the AI running on my phone, and it started deleting my stuff because it needed to make place for new mail. So it started going through my mailbox and delete everything. Wow. Because it did not have, and my rules were do not delete anything, but it would no longer respond to that, and I would not interrupt it. So I had to run and unplug the network on the machine. And you go like, okay, so you were like, she prompted it to not do it. The thing still did it. She asked it to stop doing it. It continued doing it, and the only way to cut that was to unplug a network cable. The other one that I saw was a reminder of how people lack some knowledge of isolation at the operating system level. But someone realized that his cloud setup had compromised his machine while trying to do something he asked, because because the session did not have the permissions to do it.
Yep.
So it asked to do something. Claude ran into file system permission restrictions. Oh, you can't read that file. You need to be root. Okay, well, I'm running. I have Docker as a group. Docker can escalate to root, so I can use that to escalate, access the file. And the guy was like, oh, so you do realize that you actually have a tool that's essentially root on your machine. So whatever filter you put to restrict it, it might just decide to go over it. And if you did not like really segregate it in a very isolated thing, it has your privileges. If you were able to do it, it's able to do it as well. Yeah. That's one thing that's very interesting, because it has the potential to destroy everything if it's root. There's no other restriction that might happen. I know that at my company we are a few who try to isolate things a bit. For example, I have a Claude account, Unix account that runs Claude. I connect to the Claude account, which is fairly isolated. The other one runs this into a VM that has very, very high level of mitigations around to avoid escaping. But still, you can't foresee how smart it will, like what smart way it will use to evade this. And it has potential to delete something on the assumption that it's in the past of what you're asking it to do. Yeah, I'm asking you to do this. Deleting this is what makes me able to solve this. So let's delete that. And so the only logic that follows is, well, it's bound to delete stuff. So unless you have backups, you have no way to recover it. It's like we went from convenience backup to actually just assume your data is going to be lost on an experiment and an LLM going rogue on whatever task. So you have to anticipate this much more than you used to have to.
Yeah, I think that is the right perspective. The thing that boggles the mind is, you know, over the past 6 months, people have been running things like OpenClaw and handing it, you know, credentials to, like, to your point, to emails and everything. And I'm like, what are you doing? It's like the biggest insider threat I've ever seen from an information security and, to your point, a data integrity standpoint, because they're non-deterministic systems. You can't trust what they're going to do.
And also the fact that you can now code without understanding code means that a lot of people have been not to say it's a bad thing, but they go into a project, mm-hmm. a project and have it completed, but they have no like, say, general culture about how to do things right. So it's not necessarily viewed as a like risky thing to give a token. Like, to me or you, it would make, like, you would you understand that there's an issue doing that. You at the moment you type your token, which is a secret component, you're understanding the implication of doing it. Some they don't. They just they assume the thing will just do what they say. So if they don't tell it to break something, it won't break something. And then they realize that, oh well, actually when I gave that token, that had huge implications. And now I did make a project, but it also deleted my database and my customers, and I did not know what was supposed to be done for mitigation of that. We live in a new era on that. It's fun times.
Fun times. If anything, it continues to give people like us jobs from now until eternity, just because that you're right, that discipline is necessary. Otherwise, we're just operating software that the AIs have built. We're not paying attention to the source code. We don't understand the algorithms. We don't understand the architecture. And so we are at best operating like IT staff that was just handed a piece of code and say, go run it.
That's true. And even for engineers, we open the Ubuntu program and we receive so many contributions, and we do defenses on this, explain the code that you provide, and you realize that even people who used to code, a lot of them are like becoming lazy on this, and they don't want to understand the implications of that. They just want the product, like the result of a task, without having to worry about the logic to reach that point. And when you tie that to that, when you tie that to something that's just a compute, well, worst case, you have a wrong result. That's not a big deal. But when you have your data that's tied to it, be it a database, be it a model, be it a customer data, in the worst case, it's not small bugs. It's no longer that something produced the wrong result. I do another run. Possibly did something wrong. It change data in the data set in ways that you can't undo anymore. It has repercussions that go far beyond just producing a small piece of code.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, the risk is huge. So hopefully at this point, you have scared enough listeners to motivate them to action, right? Like that's the point of this conversation, at least for me. Like, I really want to give people a public service announcement. Back up your stuff. So with that in mind, what practical steps can we take, you know, today to improve our backup posture for our personal data as well as our company data? What should we start doing if we're starting from zero?
Yeah. So the very first thing I would do, and I would encourage everyone to do, is just first to classify your data. Like, take a focused time, not something that you do while you watch a show. Yeah, you focus your time on thinking about whatever data you have, where it is, and how valuable it is, and assume that you lost it all, like no recovery path today. And which one you think would put you in a very, very bad situation, and like make a table of this, like classifying things in terms of that's very critical, that would annoy me but not that much, I can get back on fit on that, and then this provides you a value for your data. You can actually reason in terms of how much money you're going to put in front of each of the data sets, because that's not the idea is that Like if you have few data, it's easy to take everything and copy paste. But as we know, more and more data is here. If you have terabytes and terabytes of data, and you have to move them to various places, and you have to have them offsite, the cost of having hosting per month per terabyte everywhere is not necessarily affordable to everyone. So first is classifying the importance. Then you put a price on top of it as to how much you're willing to pay per month. Yeah, to save that data, which is not necessarily your whole budget, and you're going to pay that much, but it's a cap on. If I were to pay more than that, that would be annoying. I would rather lose the data than pay that much. But this gives you a general idea of how much effort you're going to pour into your backups. Yeah, so that's the first step. If you don't have a categorization of your data, like unless you're able to backup everything, you're not doing things right, because you have no plan possible on how to do multi-site stuff like that, because that really depends on how much you're willing to pay on that. Yeah. Once you have that, based on the criticality, you're going to ask yourself how many copies should I have of this? Because the thing is, you have we have it on our website, but people can find it easily. There are statistics about the rate of loss of data, like general industry rate of loss of data, and you have a high probability of losing your data if you have only one copy on your machine. But once you go three data sets, you have a higher probability of being struck by the lightning three times in a year, which is maybe acceptable for a lot of people to take that risk. Yeah, you have one per, I don't know, 50 billions probabilities of losing your whole data set. Yeah, and that you can match against your criticality of data. This is critical, but based on the statistic, I might store two copies rather than three, or I might store four rather than three, which is unlikely in the industry. But I might store four copies just because, even one in a 50 billion is not enough to reassure me. Yeah, but you know how these copies, they map to the cost. So if you see that one copy at a place costs that much, and you happen to know reason that this should be at three places, then you have to like reassess your table, because maybe that shifts other stuff. Once you have that, it's actually doing the first copy, so you're sure that everything is backed up, and then you can take time doing the others properly. But you should, like, if you have no backup initially, get one copy right away. This is this is really from the horror story at all. This is what saved the database in from going extinct. They had no copy. They did one copy, and I told them, do a shit copy. We don't care if it's nice, plugged, industrialized, infrastructure. Just do one copy today, and we do it properly after, but we have to have a safety net on that. Once you have that, you can take your time to do the multiple copies everywhere, and that goes by selecting the provider, thinking if you want to have it at two different providers in case one goes bankrupt, I don't know. And this is a rationale that you take based on that table that you initially do. And you see why it is the first step towards all the others. Yeah. And the last step to me is what software you use. Because the software is the end to do it, the means to do it. Sorry, the end is to have the copies in a way that you're safe.
Yeah.
The software, you might at some point need multiple ones. You might use the Placard because it's the best of them all. but you can take. Yeah. You can take many decisions, and you can go like, this one I know already, so I can do this copy right away with this one, and I can move to something else and investigate which one I want to use. That takes more time, but at least you know that you have the first steps covered. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I think that's very practical. I think it is immediately actionable. So listeners, do what Gilles tells you.
Do your backups.
Do your backups. Brush your teeth, comb your hair, do your backups. No, that's awesome. I really appreciate that, and I'm sure listeners will too.
You know, one thing about Dan is that if you ask a CTO at a fairly large company how confident he is about the backups, what you see is a hierarchy of people blanking. They go like, he's not sure, because he assumed the bottom, like people right below know, but they're not sure, so they propagate the fear, because they didn't, like, very few companies, actually, from my experience, there's a lot of companies that do it, but in proportion to the entire world of companies, very few do this kind of work of categorizing the data. And so they don't necessarily know how safe they are, how many copies they have, where it is it accessible, was it checked recently? And that's the best way to scare people in the corporate world. Just ask them their policy, and just ask them did you do your backup? Yeah, we did it. Are you sure? Can you restore them? Are you like, do you fear if we trash your dataset right now? And yeah, no, like I've never seen someone telling me confidently, yeah, yeah, we can trash everything. Everyone's in the hoop that someone else does the thing correctly.
Ain't that the truth? Someone else owns it, therefore nobody owns it. No, that's right. All right, so to change gears a little bit as we wrap up the episode, let's discuss a killer quote from a recent article that you wrote about preventative maintenance in software and technical debt in general. So you wrote this, quote, "In most teams, the time allocated to maintenance is a consequence of incidents or reports. Something breaks, somebody complains, and time appears. That means the maintenance you end up doing is corrective, and corrective maintenance is reactive by nature. You're not deciding what to work on, the failures are deciding for you. The tempting answer is that it evens out in the end. Incidents happen, incidents force you to fix things, so the debt gets repaid eventually. I don't believe that, and I don't think anyone who's been on call believes it either," unquote. Very interesting point. Very compelling point. Our listeners need to hear it. Big question to you, though. Why?
So this was an article that I wrote weeks ago based on a talk that I gave, that I prepared for a company, like an internal talk. And this was kind of relying on multiple experiences I had as an architect. So I was looking at multiple teams and validating schemas and stuff like that, but also invited in all incidents channel that could pop up at some place. Mm-hmm. And from my experience as a developer on open source, and also because I studied organizational psychology, so I had like these three things that kind of melted together. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And the thing is that code is a very creative process. So where you actually come to a result by thinking about the possibilities to reach that result, and so you build a mental plan of this, and you have this done throughout your career. So every project you do feeds into the next ones, where you have already tried something, already reasoned about similar problem, made assumptions, tested these assumptions, saw which one worked and did not work. Yeah. And so there's no better time for you to improve code than when you have time allocated to read and see, oh, this is not written in the correct way now. I did it a few months ago, but since then, I gain new knowledge about how things should be done. And that would be more reliable if I did it that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that rarely, outside of the open source world where you have no real deadline and you can actually have something that spans over multiple months, companies are driven by releases, which is like understandable because you have to make releases and sell. But usually features are prioritized far more than anything corrective, and the maintenance is assumed to be something you do when you have an incident. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you run into an incident, everyone's stressed out, a customer is yelling because everything is broken, and now you have someone that does a quick fix, and that's assumed to be a maintenance, and it does fix the bug, but it does not fix it in a way that's let's say reliable. It fixes it in a way that's reactive, like that's the best I could come up in the shortest time or shortest period of time.
Yes.
And so you can think of it as it does not take into account like the entire project and how this might affect some other parts of the project. Does not take into account that this might need to be let's say copy pasted everywhere in the project where you have similar patterns. You should have an audit and do this, classes of bugs, fixes on this, which is, for example, what OpenBSD does. Bug is reported, you scan the entire tree and you fix this everywhere. Yeah. I've never seen that happen at a company. What I've seen happen is that you have an incident, the incident gets a quick fix. In a very ideal world, people would have some very, very small allocated time to try to make it a bit nicer than during the incident, but it's not time to actually improve the code base. Yeah? And so as time passes by, you accumulate all these kind of small fixes that are incoherent one with another. Maybe two issues stem from a similar bug that should have been fixed upfront. That's without the correct design might lead to another third one elsewhere. That's caused by an incorrect design. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this is what I called preventive maintenance, is that You are very like you're very happy to give some newcomer that does not know the code base some time to study it. Like that makes sense to most people, but the people who know the code base could actually make big major improvements to the code base without needing a lot of time. Do not get any time allocated to do it, or rarely do it. Which means that there's no chance to cover that up. Yeah, and on top of that, you know that a lot of projects they have. Like given short time frames to achieve a feature, they will take shortcuts. These shortcuts, the developers, they know that they exist. They really know that this is a shortcut. That's not how it should be done. Yeah. We do it because it has to be a pragmatic solution right now with the intent that I would go back to fix it. But if no time is allocated to do it, that shortcut becomes the norm and you only have a ton of shortcut, which makes no sense to someone that studies the code. Because they're not logical. It's just like a big mess of patches here and there. And also, well, since it's a shortcut, it's not part of a design that you have mentalized, like internalized as being, this is how the project works. So when you revisit 6 months from now, does not make sense to you either. You recall doing the shortcut. You don't necessarily recall what are the interaction with that and that and what could possibly lead from there, and so the preventive maintenance is a mod where you would allocate time like regularly in the same sense as any feature. You would have time to actually do the cleanups, and these cleanups have to be developer decided because they know what they did, and it can be something where you have like you can use OKRs and stuff like that to actually try to word it a bit, like you have to fix three things. But it's not a PO or a CTO that has to say, oh, during that time, that's what you need to fix. Because you have no idea when you're external to the code to how much of a brittle brick that is that they're trying to fix versus what you think is brittle but might not be that much. Yeah. And then this, when you put it like in front of some of the incident that I saw in the past, you have teams that did it naturally. They would hide it, but they would overestimate the time it takes to make features, to make some room to do this. And these are the teams, when they are in an incident room, they understand what they're doing and they go straight. They have the intuition because they internalize the model. So if a bug happens, they can right away say, it can be that, it can be that. It has to be around this and it can be that because blah, blah, blah. And they've like pinpointed at least a small part of the code that's responsible for that. And you see them doing it very comfortably, And there are teams that have incident that you would think, oh, should take 2 days to fix. And they're like spending a week, no one knows where to look at and they internalize nothing, So I think that's a big part of the quality process. And if you don't do it, what turns out is that the value of your product decreases because the more and more hacks, the more and more technical debt, and the more and more it is costly to do anything with your project, making any API evolve, any maintenance happen. I think it's a good practice. Myself, I encourage having we introduced it recently, but we call it Friday Third Shining, where on Friday you clean up what has to be cleaned up, not new feature, just clean up what you have to clean up, and if the code base is better, we all win ultimately. And if you don't have anything to clip, well, good. One more date for features, like one more comfort day for features. But at least you have that time allocated to undo what we have to do when we are trying to get something delivered in a rush. So you also have this relaxed mindset that, I know what I'm doing is not fully correct, but I know that on Friday I'll be able to clean it up. Which never happened at previous companies.
I love that. The Friday turd shining. Every company should have a Friday turd shining. 100%. One final remark I'll make the reason why I jumped at that quote when I read it is that, you know, as an SRE practitioner, we talk about SLOs and error budgets and using error budgets to enforce fixes. But in reading that article, you reminded me that is a backstop. If your system is no longer reliable and you have to force a team to prioritize reliability work, that's the last resort.
But you see how it's always a bit less on tech companies, and even though tech companies, they're still you have short time frames to achieve something that happens. But in companies where you have tech and business that are like not the same industry, for example, you have the tech to serve another purpose than tech. Yeah. You have a high pressure to deliver stuff, and the tech is a side defect of it. And since reliability is not something that people understand, like non-tech people understand, they will not wrap their head around the fact that you have to do something that will waste you a week to actually make sure that this does not go into an incident. So you have product owners or related roles that will not put that in a roadmap. The roadmap is features. It's what you have to deliver. Yes. Reliability is a side product of it that's invisible. Yeah. But the reality of things is that in tech, it's not invisible. It's things that you have to take time to do it. If you don't, you have some teams that are generally smart enough to over-exaggerate the features to manage to find that time by themselves, which is, to me, pathological. An organization should not be in that state. Yeah, but that's at least some teams do it. And you have teams that do not have this, that have the pressure of a business to deliver and no time to do any cleanup. And you end up with something that's not maintainable. I've had, like, not many times in my career, I rarely rewrite something that someone else did. It's almost never happens because I'm not in the, like, I'm old enough to know how to not throw everything to do something myself just to have it done myself. Yeah. But it's been like two times I had to trash the code entirely because cleaning it up and maintaining it was undoing so many of the hacks that they did during all the incident that they had before, that I would rather start away because I would take less more time to have something reliable than just try to clean up the mess. And that's the worst thing you can, like, the worst state you can reach is that everything we did so far without taking any time for maintenance has put it in a state where there's nothing you can do anymore and it's easier to start from scratch. So, like, that's the worst that could happen to a project because it means the value has dropped almost to zero.
There it is. I didn't have to say it. There it is. You said it. That's the thesis. Your software has to provide value. If it's not reliable, it doesn't work and customers won't use it. Now, that's awesome. So we're just about at time. To wrap up, how can people reach you if they're interested in Placker or interested in talking to you about all the various things you've been doing?
So we are on Discord. You can go to Placker.io, mm-hmm. our website. There's a link to Discord. We are on GitHub. So you have GitHub Placker Corp, which is with a K. Yeah. Placker Corp key. All our repos have a link to our Discord, but you can start discussion there and open PRs there if you want. I answer to mail and I'm fairly reachable. Not very hard to find.
No, very good. Gilles, a pleasure. This has been an amazing conversation.
Thanks. It was a pleasure for me too. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to today's edition of Reliability Rebels. Until next time. Check one, check two. Reliability level. Check one, check two. Reliability level. Check, 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 check. Reliability level.